So all of these things become just tremendously important. Of course, like I said, you know, this whole skin in the game, and we're really going to get into that more here shortly, is we know beyond a shadow of a doubt, if you got a dream, and you can take that dream to a goal, which has some sort of reality to it, then I can break that goal down to say, you know what, if I've got an action plan and I need to do step one, step two, step three, step four, but then I can take that action plan and break it to one more level so it becomes systematic and orderly and a process. Because we as human beings, we need to feel some degrees of success, especially us men. You know, some things that you get into for us guys, we're very objective. We're conquering. We want to overcome. And it's just what makes our minds up. I don't know if you guys know this or not, but in all actuality, when baby boys are born, there's a chemical process that takes place in our brains where literally we have a chemical washdown and it separates one half of our brain from the other. So we think left side, right side. Well, a female does not have that chemical reaction. They can work out of both sides of their brain at the same time. That's why traditionally you hear people talk about most men typically are right brain. That's where we work off of all of the calculations and the functions and the order and that conquering, steady, steady grinding through. You know, we typically get to the same solution as our wives or girlfriends most of the time. They just tend to get there faster than we do. So if you ask yourself why, really, their brain's working kind of like a computer. It's bouncing back and forth, back and forth. While ours is kind of crunching on one side like an old-timey calculator that you pull a handle on. We'll get to the same total. It just takes us long. Well, for us guys, because we are conquering, but most mission work tends to be done with men in that loop, we tend to have that conquering mode as we actually are trying to help people in the process. So there's a lot of effect that goes on. If you understand it, you can begin to work around it. But what we'll do is we'll kind of proceed on a little through some more of this, and then we'll pick up some more points of interest, and then we can talk about that. And again, we talked about the needs-based, and there's some degree that this does help, but we do have to be careful because we can always accomplish more understanding the resources that the people we're trying to help already have. Once we begin to identify the assets, and when it's appropriate, actually ask the poor individuals or a community the questions, then we can actually talk about what you're listening to them. And that's as much of a part of this process as what you identify, is that you're listening to what they're telling you. It's kind of like us talking about the funeral today.
Yeah.
That was a perfect example. If I hadn't been there, for me as an American, that's a hard thing to get your mind around, to understand the poorest people in the world that you can possibly see in that geographical area of this world, to how much of their finances and savings they will expend to create this burial process. It's almost mind-boggling.
Yes.
If you don't understand it. But it is incredibly draining on their resources. So that's a challenge that has to be thought about. Are we going to fix it completely? No. But do we have a potential impact? And I've always looked at it. I'd like, when I've gone to Ghana, I'd like to know that, hey, yeah, I can impact a million people. But you know what? Impacting a million people starts with one.
Yes.
So as long as we think in terms of, and the work that you'll see that I try to be involved in, I would encourage you, is to think in terms of, if I can help one or five or ten, and they in turn help one, five, or ten, it'll expand itself much broader than anything I can contribute to personally. So that's why what we're doing here in this context of me sharing this, I'm hoping that you can truly use these concepts to spread. there are immediate problems, and like I said, cultural and traditional things that aren't necessarily problems, but they can be a challenge to work around. So, obviously, anybody that can bring what they consider their assets, and that's not all material items, obviously. Sometimes it's merely their own capabilities, their mind thoughts, the things of the relationship that they have with someone. All those can be assets. Now, common approaches is what we call an asset mapping, where you literally, you go into a community or you're working with a group of people, and you're literally just writing up a list of saying, what do they dream about? How can you help them solve their problem? And there's what's called a blueprint approach, came out years ago, and it's used heavily in American business because it is efficient. There is no doubt about it. That we can map out, we can say, that little thing I was telling you on the whole action plan process, you follow the list, you do it this way, it makes things happen. But again, when it gets over into those environments, it doesn't necessarily create the ownership process because it's done for them instead of with them. So that's where you got to be careful to use pieces of the blueprint, but only as guidance. Not to take away from the ownership of the local indigenous people involved in it. Okay? And this part of this is actually a learning process that basically, once you involve the people, that you want to create a sense of enthusiasm, but not an out of control enthusiasm. Not a thing to think that's beyond what's realistic. So you want to know that, hey, We're presenting this in a way that this is achievable, but not in a way to set them up for failure. That becomes very important for the participants involved. And then, obviously, when the project is theirs and they own it, they're going to sacrifice at an incredible level to try to make sure that success is sustained over the long haul. And obviously, the knowledge and skills that they bring to the table themselves is what's going to keep it going. And like I said, as I share a little more of the specific stories of Ghana, you'll see a lot of these patterns from a real-world perspective that I've been involved in. The big thing to pay attention to is not one size fits all. So the level of participation for your church and your missionaries is obviously different from my church. You cannot try to compare the two in any way, shape, or form. You can learn from each other, but they're not the same. So the participation obviously depends on the host and the type of mission work and the intervention that you're even looking at. And it's all about really this whole fostering the cooperation model and co-learning and participation with each other and then tying it, like you said, together, working with UCY, in other words, and you're going to know besides yourself, there are going to be key individuals as we talk through things or y'all discuss opportunities in the future. You're going to go, wow, so-and-so is perfect for that, you know, type thing. So again, in some of the examples I'll be sharing with you, hopefully will help you to correlate some things, not to say to duplicate it, but to create ideas from it. Okay? All right. Now, on the donor alert, what we have to be real careful with here, and this is not uncommon too, just like we look at the whole time issue that we're going to concentrate on a mission and we got to get it done because that's the American way and da da da. Same thing can happen with the money side, the investment. Because all of a sudden, we're thinking of how are we leveraging those dollars? How are we getting the biggest bang for the buck because we're the good stewards? And that's all appropriate to a point. But again, you got to ask, How can the poorest people in the world can save money? And I'm going to show that to you here in a little bit. It's amazing when you see some of the concepts we're going to talk about. But what the donors have to remember is this is a gift. And if I gift you something, how you use it is your business. I lose all attachment to it at that point.
Amen.
And that's what it needs to be. And if you're going to struggle to think outside of that box, you're going to have trouble dealing with it from now on. So again, I would rather just raise that as part of the issue when I'm talking to large crowds and groups. You kind of got to share that story, even though it might be a little unpleasant at times, you know, type thing. Because you don't have control over that if you gift it or donate to it. Short-term missions without long-term harm. And it's like we were saying earlier, all of a sudden, that the good stewardship of time means we're getting the most out of every minute. There's always, you know, there's always more time. You know, we got to go, we got to go. And obviously the culture's different. I'm going to get into in a minute the reason why these cultures vary on time and self issues, but it's very important to understand. In our culture, we're taught to be individualistic, stand on our own two feet, or at least we were up until the last few years, I guess. But anyway, we're built around make it happen, go, 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 get it done. Where a collectivist culture in a third world is more about a community process. It's more about the relationship and the well-being of the group. And getting things done quickly is not what the development's all about. Development's the lifelong process, not a two-week project from a short-term mission. And that's why sometimes it can harm you with the best of intentions. Now let's talk about this concept of time. The U.S. is the most extreme in monochromatic conditions, where Africa is on the other side in a polychromatic condition. And neither one are good or bad, they're just different. But again, this is all about individualism in the U.S. side. It drifts through the United Kingdom is next. Then Japan is about in the middle. China's kind of a little right, going toward the poly side, and Mexico, and then, of course, Africa for the most part, because it's built around the tribal systems. It's built around the community and the communal societies of life. So when you take a U.S.-dominated team trying to move in this environment, it's real easy to get out of kilter when you're just dealing with time alone. A lot of people, it's one of the most intriguing things whenever I talk to church groups and just bigger crowds. This type of stuff is one of the hardest things there is to try to communicate across a thing. But I think you could probably already see it just from being here. When you look at the traffic and you see just all the motion, all the activity. And it's not that your cities don't have an activity. I mean, it's like going into Accra in southern Ghana versus moving up to one of the north. I mean, it's like being in two different worlds and you're in the same country. Mm-hmm. So this kind of gives you a feel for the concept of time and the variances from a Western world view versus a third world view. The other side of it is the concept of self, as we talked about, from the U.S. being on an individualistic mode of operation versus the collectivism. You know, one of the things that I found and really got my mind swirling when I first got to Ghana was beginning to understand that if a family member, if he did acquire some wealth through selling or doing something, or he'd gotten a bicycle or whatever, it was nothing uncommon for his brother, his children, whoever else in the family, or even in the village, to come to them and want part of that. So therefore, it made it extremely difficult to retain any wealth gained because of this belief in sharing and communal society and things, that it was depleted very quickly from outside resources. And we'll get into that a little more, but that's all part of this puzzle as we look at this. Now, one thing, I want to read a quick story to you. And this is actually told by an African Christian to a friend. It says, Elephant and Mouse were best friends. One day Elephant said, Mouse, let's have a party. So the animals gathered from near and far. They ate, they drank, they sang, and they danced. And nobody celebrated more and danced harder than the elephant. After the party was over, the elephant exclaimed, "Mouse, did you ever go to a better party? What a blast." But the mouse did not answer. "Mouse, where are you?" elephant called. He looked around for his friend and then shrank back in horror as there laying at the elephant's feet lay the mouse. His little body was ground into the dirt. He had been smashed by the big feet of his exuberant friend. "Sometimes that's what it's like to do a mission trip with you Americans," the African storyteller told. "It's like dancing with an elephant." So we can be the big feet in the room if we're not careful at times. Now, part of the whole thing, and again, we're building towards something for you guys, and I think you're catching on to this, is one of the biggest things I've learned is creating the proper association for the indigenous people themselves take on more and more of a role that they can truly handle and be successful with. The other side of it, again, it's not just the businesses and the ways to create businesses, the ways to create financial support and all of that, but it's truly about how to use it as an opportunity to create the relationship so there can be a witnessing process as part of it. But what we have found out in many situations from some surveys is, unfortunately, short-term mission team goes over. They got all their flannel art. They got all their big posters. They got all this fancy stuff. And they go into a community that's already been holding a small Bible study with the children in the area. And they've got a local school like we do, where we have chapel and all those kind of things. And all of a sudden, our team hits the ground with all this fancy American stuff. Well, then, it's like this lady tells in this story here. It tells that after the Americans leave, children stop coming. But then it's because they said, "Well, you don't have all this stuff the Americans had." So it becomes a competition for what they perceive as the quality of the event, when really that was never the intention. So I know that what we've tried to do is, when we do go, is try to leave our materials in place so that at least they have things that would create the same attraction if we're trying to enhance, you know, the materials they're using and things. But again, sometimes we can actually cause them to lose people if we're not careful. And that's from actually a real story there. Now, the dollars and cents, because we got to ask ourselves, what's the actual impact of the trip? What do we want to learn? Because it's not about us. It's not about them. It's all about Him. And what are we doing for God in the process? So we have to ask ourselves, what is this trip going to accomplish? Is it needed? Or do we just need to send the money that we would use to get on a plane and go? Sometimes it's appropriate both ways. And obviously, knowing that the local indigenous people are prepared to meet the needs of their community doesn't necessarily always require us on the field. Okay? But the reason I want to share this with you, CY, is the fact that there may well be an opportunity that you guys have that conversation at some point down the road to say, "As much as I'd love to see you, we could do this and this for one airplane ticket." Mm-hmm. And that's a conversation you should have.
Yeah.
But sometimes, because you are on a battlefield, out there doing, it's an encouragement to have a friend that supports you and be there with you for a time, because it shores you up at times. And you know what? That's worth the cost of a plane ticket when that's appropriate. But it's about talking about it is really what becomes important. Okay? One of the critical things about short-term missions is really thinking about how we design the field experience. Understanding that nature of the poverty that you're going to experience as an American. Making sure that the lead indigenous decision makers are involved in the process. And for you to make recommendations on what's going to be done or not done. Because we're going to make assumptions if we're not careful. Okay? It's designing a trip about being and learning, and really as much about doing something. What do we bring back so we can better serve you? You certainly want to get insights from the local believers to go along with the team members about what God is and how He works in their lives. That's one thing as I look at our teams going with me to Ghana on the next trip. That's more about, I want those kids to talk to those other kids. Tell me, explain to me your life here. What is it like to live and have to walk 3 miles to put a pail of water on your head and walk back home every day survive? What is it like to live off of the equivalent of $3 to $5 a month for your entire family?
I think that nobody really reviews that. It just, I accept it as a status quo, mm-hmm. put it that way.
That
I mean, I wake up every morning to go to that stream to get water because it's my routine.
That's
no
correct.
Question asked.
That's
now,
correct.
You seeing me from outside and say, what? I mean, I said, this is my paradigm. I mean,
mm-hmm. exactly.
I have to go with it.
That's one of the greatest challenges that I found because most indigenous people in that part of the world, they live in a survival mode, whether it's going and getting a pail of water every day. When you watch children this tall carrying a coffee can on their heads being trained, even though in 20 years there may well be water right there in their village, they can't assume it. They're still training because that's the way they were trained.
Exactly.
And it is on and on. But what happens is they tend to live in basically a survivalist mode. So whenever you live day to day or week to week at best because you've got a little cart that you're selling your peppers or your cucumbers or whatever on, it's hard to take and think all of a sudden, how will my life be in a month? How will my life be in a year? That's not even as part of a thought process. So these are things, again, we're going to be talking about more because it just doesn't exist in that world. So again, touching base on the paternalism, no matter what we do in designing the field experience, it's just a void to do what you and your people could do for themselves. Okay? Now, there's a recruiting and screening process that's highly recommended for developing and putting together a short-term mission team. And this is a bit of a misguided process that we tend to have. Again, I can share from my own experience because my first trip to Ghana, I just had it fully envisioned. I was going over there with a pocket full of money and I was going to solve all their problems. But a gentleman spoke at our church, and he had been part of this Chalmers group that helped change my understanding of the needs there. And this is part of it, is that we got to stay away from the go help and I'm going to save them process to go, I'm as a learner, so I can learn better how to help you process. That the fact that missions is not a vacation, and we definitely don't want to use a church's tithes and offerings for funding anything associated with that type of a trip, because that's certainly not a misuse of funding. And the consideration of a short-term mission trip to really becoming more of a vision trip. And this is one that I'm talking to our team about, go, learn, return, and respond. Because what I'm looking for from our seniors of our mission group and our future college kids, I'm 58. I've only got relatively so many more years that I know I can do what I do. But is there possibly one in that group that could take over and take the role I make, maybe being a 20-something year old, and then provide a lifelong process to them where I'm coming in late? I don't know, but I'm certainly willing to explore that if it's offered to me. But the learning experience for the team is really the critical aspect of it, and it is much more bigger than the ending to itself. In other words, it just has to be part of the whole thing, is the learning experience from it. Another area that's important for the short-term mission team from here, and this is why...
Gary, before you leave that, can you back up that one again?
Sure.
What did, just early on when some of the trips that you took, what, after you went there, what did you see that you changed about the trip itself that kept people away from this kind of mentality?
I think the big thing was really, it's differentiating once I got there. Like I said, there, as part of the culture, there's a survival mode of people that are just there. They're engaged. They're part of the local churches. They're part of things. But I began to realize that there were some key individuals that I was like, you know, wow, this person had a chance, because I can see that they're past the mud hut. They've taken it on their thing to at least plaster their walls. Their hut's not washing away. So I begin to notice degrees of self-ownership or self-processes. So that's what really got in my mind to say, what if this person had an opportunity to own a sheep herd? What if this person had an opportunity to buy and sell? The challenge came from in creating this, for me personally, on this go, learn, return, and respond. That's really what happened to me. I came back thinking I'm going to go solve a lot of problems with a lot of money, but I came back realizing the need was way beyond anything I could do, just one-to-one. So how do I engage people? How do I change other people's thoughts and processes? But for my personal response, that's whenever I said, you know what, if I could channel my own energy and my own passion and bring this thing down a notch and say, how can I take my business skills and help them apply, not as an American, but as a Ghanaian, then how do we put this together? But I literally turned on this concept right here, Dustin, or for me. Because I knew once I went the first time, again, my life was changed forever at that point, how I was going to be involved in it.
Well, years ago, we was in another church in another environment. I had a problem with that, with people. Some people I would take to do things. But I have to say that with after getting connected with Dr. Carey, and, well, actually with his uncle, Clement Amati, and then with Dr. Carey, that the that they had so, because they both had lived here, they did such a good job. We were just in the process of the whole plan for the thing.
Right.
It was already, but, and not that it there weren't quirks in that, but some of that. Because the way they viewed it, you know, it was never really someone that grew up as a Westerner that was planning it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, see, that's unfortunately an experience most churches don't have. They don't have that kind of leadership in that whole development and recruiting process to get the right people there to have that knowledge. And unfortunately, they do it with the best of intentions. But that's awesome. Y'all have that kind of relationship.
And this guy sitting right here, he is a, I mean, you talk about, we go there and been there. Nothing's wasted.
Right.
There's no wasted money. There's no wasted effort.
Right.
The people are put in place to be used while they're there in their giftings, you know. And not asking you to do something that's out of your realm of anyway. And just him being here is a good example of what the point you made on the screen before.
Right.
You
right. know. No, absolutely.
Deciding to, you know, it was Gary's idea to,
I understand.
When we started talking about it, I said, well, see why it would be a great, and Gary said, well, why don't we bring him here?
Exactly. You know, because again, when someone like you brings an energy and a realism to a process, then when you're trying to get as many things done as we can in the short amount of time that we all have to do in a traditional missions environment, the cost and the time to contribute and put that information in your hands much faster and be able to deploy what you can do and you feel comfortable doing is invaluable. I mean, it's just a much greater, unfortunately, for lack of a better term, investment of everybody's time and energy and process. But it is important that the people that are going truly understand why they're going. And unfortunately, sometimes, like I said, that's gotten probably a little out of kilter over the years. And we talk about the training, and I know you guys do it in y'all's pre-trip training, but unfortunately, again, too many times, there's really not. It's kind of like planning a vacation. It's not really a thing to say, what are we going to try to do? But how do we take, and especially here, whenever we get into, is that how much time do we just spend instead of going is working with the people, getting to know the people and understand. And literally for ourselves on the field, and I'm sure you guys have had it, we've gone over with a certain schedule, but you shift gears as necessary because you change in order to meet that need or say, hey, we can glean more by doing this instead of this, even though this was the first plan.
You better do it.
Better, that's right. But because so many are so regimented, they just don't get that part of it done. And then it's really important to have follow-up training and use that as you come back. And not only amongst the team that goes, but the team sharing with other church members to say, what did we learn from this part? And actually affect how their thinking is affected and create a life-changing event. Now, in funding the trip, part of what I'm working on now for this particular trip, again, why it's important to me, because every one of my trips, my wife and I have personally paid for. We've not used any funds from our church to do this, because I want to make certain, for one thing, I don't want to deplete resources that are needed other places, obviously. But I assure you, because of my personal investment in my time and the finances, I'm going to try to do everything I can to make it the best possible experience for those I'm trying to help and use my resources as effectively as I can. Now, normally what we find, and I've encouraged this, matter of fact, I was meeting with our youth pastor yesterday, and I said, you know, the kids that are going to go on this need to do something to earn part of their way to do this, to take some ownership of their own process to this mission. And that's kind of what this is about a little bit. And again, we're not trying to save the world on a short-term mission trip. We're going there for a specific, you know, reason. And then obviously, really and truly, the short-term missions can be an incredible benefit, but you really got to pay attention to the pros and cons of it. Wealth accumulation. Wealth provides the buffer that people need in order to survive. But unfortunately, There's very small percentage of the Earth's population that you would truly consider has what we know as wealth accumulation. It obviously has the chance of generating additional income. The process of saving and managing wealth develops positive attitude, self-discipline, requiring people to replace a live for today survival mentality with a live for the future investment mentality. And this gets back to what we were talking about a little earlier. It's just like you go get that pail of water every day. But one of the big things before I'll ever get into the whole micro business and microfinance role or any things I do is I spend at least a year typically developing a person's understanding of their own financial responsibility. the poorest people, like I said, in the world. I have gone into a mud hut that only half of it was roof, that a little old lady is sitting in there, and she's grinding and grinding shea nuts to make oil. And that little bottle of oil, she'll basically sell in the market for the equivalent of about $5. But out of that little bottle of oil, she has the potential to save a dollar. So it's an amazing thing, and we're going to talk a little more about the potential savings, because again, when you live in a survival mode, and you're just trying to put water and food on the table, it's very difficult to think, how do I control whatever finances that I do have? One of the biggest problems I found in trying to help people in developing businesses over in West Africa was their misunderstanding from intermixing their personal funds with the capital investment of their companies or businesses. They couldn't keep them separated. So they expended their capital. Then they had no way to reinvest in inventory and those kind of things. So part of the whole process that I go through is making sure they truly understand the savings concept and what they can do for themselves. And once they demonstrate that, hey, I have the discipline, then there's a lot of other things you can work with that person to do. So that unto itself is very important to understand. And wealth accumulation is not a bad thing if it's used properly. In the economic development side of it, there's appropriate forms of microfinance. And then again, there's a support training for small business management. There's the household financial management aspect, like we were just talking about. There's a role for businesses' missions. Broken economic systems in various countries, it's like Ghana. Ghana has really a pretty stable situation. And let's face it, they've got tons of gold. They got, you know, diamonds. They got the other precious stones. They just discovered billions of dollars worth of oil off their coast. But you know what? With the best of intentions, that whole economic system, because of politicians, to make a disaster of all those opportunities, and unfortunately in too many third world countries, they do. Okay? Typically, what hurts economic development too is the farmers and the micro entrepreneurs' access to capital, just access to raw dollars. And again, I'm going to share a little bit with you in the various concepts of that. And then the absence of banking services. This is one of the biggest things that got my attention before my first trip to Ghana. This guy that shared a story that had been over there working and teaching these classes, I had no comprehension that average Nigerian or an average Ghanaian, Ivory Coast, whatever, it doesn't matter, but in most third world countries, they cannot have a banking relationship the way we do in America. We can walk in and make a $5 deposit. They won't even talk to them over there for less than a certain value because their administrative cost is so high that they won't do any banking business. So the average person can't go to the bank and save money. So it tends to get stuffed under their mattress or whatever. And again, relative knows they've got some money set aside. I need the money, communal society. I loan it to you. I can't create wealth. Am I right?
Never come back.
Never come back. You're 100% correct. So because of that absence of the banking services is a tremendous driver in this whole economic condition. So that's part, again, what we're fixing to talk about is how do we help people overcome this lack of banking support. Okay? Yeah. And that's
even if you had access to a bank, it takes you 10 hours to access your money. And right. That's a whole...
It's cumbersome. That's right.
You know, that is gone.
That is correct. It takes, you just wait and wait and wait.
Yeah.
So, as we come on through this, over the last several years, there's been a huge microfinance revolution around the world. And it obviously started from that guy who won the Nobel Prize in India. He set up the big microfinance thing. Mm-hmm. And it's a great idea, there's no doubt, because most microfinance institutions, though, they cannot hardly operate on any loan less than $40 as a rule of thumb. But what we find in the poorest of the poor people, average loans that they need are typically $5 to $12. So in many situations, you can't get there from here just through microfinance. So like I said, I'm going to show you some alternative methods to work around even that program. What makes them successful is that they take and have the ability of enough capital, but the only way they can typically survive is in a large metropolitan area where their cost to provide services to thousands of people can stop and think about it. What you're trying to avoid is people going to the local loan sharks in their community that charge them 40, 50, 80% interest rates to do banking. And that's what happens, unfortunately. Yeah. The poorest people are devastated from that type of situation. But if they're rural or they're out and they're farmers, they don't have access to these metropolitan areas to get to that money. So that's a problem unto itself. But the other side of it is that to keep a microfinance of anything going or any financial institution, the people have to believe beyond a shadow of a doubt it's going to be there forever. Because if they think it's not going to be there, then why should I pay it back? Money doesn't return, bank goes under.
Yeah.
So credibility to your stability in the marketplace is absolutely critical in this whole process of microfinance. And like I said, because typically in order to get enough people involved in a microfinance, you got to be in a major hubs, so reaching the destitute poor becomes a challenge too. You just can't spread it far enough. But it has its pros and it has a viable usage, which again I'll share with you from a real world experience in Ghana. We'll get more on that tomorrow. And microfinances also tend to focus specifically on business most of the time. Or sometimes it may be a matter of a mother that needs to borrow $5 to purchase medicine for her sick child. It may be somebody needs to patch a roof on their hut, but they can't get $10 to do it because these focus on business, and that's true. And also, it doesn't have a very good foundation potentially for any evangelism or any communication related for spiritual. Now again, I'm going to share what we did in Ghana that overcomes that in a more rural environment, but it's very specialized. But again, I just want to try to share some real world things that have been successful, okay? Now, the other side of that microfinance is the Savings Credit Association. And sometimes it can actually have a much higher success rate. It's microfinance, but without outside money having to be put in it. And again, we have those running and gone very successfully. And I'll share that in detail with you. It actually empowers the poor to do a certain amount of this collective savings process for themselves without the influence of Americans, as long as they understand how to do it. And that's more of a training model. The Savings and Credit Associations are really very simple to facilitate, and they can actually begin to originate directly out of the church. And again, I have those success stories to share with you. And it also creates what's more known as a more effective partnership model between the people themselves, where they can actually reinforce each other and help each other to overcome the challenges they would face.
Believe me.
Yes, go ahead.
Here in Living Through the United States, we that know ourselves, especially among the Ethiopians, we just come together and we decide we'll make a contribution either weekly at a $400 level. Mm-hmm. And so at that week, it's your turn to take the money home.
That's correct.
Then we keep on mm-hmm. until a round of 10 people, 10 yep. weeks, everybody has got $400 multiplied by 10 mm-hmm. or for whatever you wanted to do.
Right.
And if people want to reestablish that cycle again, go through that and you go through that and it's just a way of building money up. So we've kind of imported that, which I saw in my parents,
mm-hmm.
both my mom and my dad belong to a credit savings scheme mm-hmm. like that.
Right.
Like you said, no outside money coming. And then they went on to do what they wanted.
Sure, absolutely. So there's a benefit to every piece of this. And the thing that I found is there's ways of actually blending up certain times the best of both worlds, you know, too. So these are things that, you know, I'm one of these out-of-the-box kind of guys. I'm always looking for a better mousetrap, you know, type thing. So I've done it on a small scale, but I have experimented with different ways, and they've all been successful to various degrees. So those are the things, again, from your perspective, though, I want to make sure tomorrow, especially, we're getting that feedback and share the things that you've seen in your own countries, but to say, hey, is there any piece of this that you could take potentially knowing certain people in your organization that would apply? And that's what all of this will actually be about as we, you know, look at it. Of course, the other side of it on the business's mission, and this is really regrowing. We have a gentleman in Uzbekistan that's a missionary from our church, and he is in Uzbekistan, which up until about a year or so was a pretty closed country. But he was able to access that country because he was going to open up a water purification system to support a local community. So he was allowed the permits, access to the community. And literally, he's opening this business, so therefore, he can create a Christian relationship with employees, suppliers, various people. The challenge comes from the business admissions, and it actually produces income to support himself. So he covers his own working expenses and all that kind of stuff. He can pay himself to be able to stay on the field and finance his own operation. The challenge that comes from a business admissions, though, is typically it's limited within a certain range of how many people it can influence for the ministry side of it. Because, again, if you go too far out and you're in a communist country and they kill you for doing such things, you got to kind of think about how you can grow that, you know, situation. But it does provide a very needed aspect of doing business. And it's kind of like if I understood for yourself, you have a business. You probably use that business to help support what you're trying to do and what you provide. That's a similar concept. Sometimes they're big enough to be able to have employees and all that. Sometimes they're not. It's just supporting you through your own effort. They both have admirable goals, and they're a valuable piece of this whole puzzle of what we're trying to accomplish and do. And then the role of the church, obviously, is subsidizing the training of missionaries in what we call majority world churches so that they can implement promotion and partnership and complementary training models. That's kind of like what I do. In other words, whether I'm using my own resources or whether my church has requested for me to go to another church and make a presentation, that's kind of what that's about. In other words, but I'm in a way representing my church today to share something that we've had success with that hopefully helps you have success. Becoming a trainer of trainers, that's what we look for someone like yourself, to take back as much of these, pick and choose what fits your need, and be able to pass it on yourself. Obviously, being an advocate, there is a time and a place for microfinance. There is a time and a place for business admissions. There is a time and a place for savings and credit unions. There's a place and pieces for all of this to fit where it's appropriate. It's just, again, having a good plan. Where do we fit? Where do we use it? And when becomes critical to the process. But obviously, all that comes through the prayer and the network and the financial assistance that it takes to make it operate. And that breaks us almost right on time.
Oh, wow. Thanks,
obviously, tomorrow, what I'd like to do is share with you and actually put up some and actually walk you through the true micro businesses, how we modified a microfinance program and have kept it intact, but operating it on a very small scale instead of that big demanded scale is normal. I'll show you the Savings and Credit Associates, for example, what you shared about your parents. Very similar in Southern Ghana, where things are different. So there's a lot of things, but I'll put some pictures and some faces up there for you. Because again, a lot of it you'll see is that whole pass it on methodology. For example, and you'll see him tomorrow, a gentleman who won a taxi cab. We went to his local church group because the bank wasn't loaning the money. They made the loan. Well, today, not only did he pay off that first one, he's got two more cabs. He's got two more drivers working for him. He's got a mechanic working for him. They all go to the same church. They're all paying more tithes and offerings. And the church that we were supporting to keep their maintenance of their building funded, we've not funded anything for 2 years because they've done it themselves. So, but again, I thought it'd be beneficial for you and help you maybe to relate in some of these exact specifics, and then you can say, hey, I know somebody that might work. Sound okay?
Good.